From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll learn about the efforts of the Legislative Black Caucus in the Wisconsin legislature.
Later, why the Beloit International Film Festival is so vital to that small southern Wisconsin city.
It's a great thing for the town to have this festival. It brings a lot of people in who haven't been to Beloit in a long time or they've never been. And Beloit is changing, and we wanted to see that.
And singer and Wauwatosa native Grace Weber talks about coming to terms with a pretty amazing development, a contract with Capitol Records.
The Capitol thing helps me recalibrate it too in a way of like, you know what, let me just enjoy this for a second. And my album is done, so I've been enjoying that and really like enjoying the moment, which sounds cliche, but hey, it's the truth.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Wisconsin's Legislative Black Caucus is celebrating Black History Month in Milwaukee and Madison with events throughout February that address issues facing the Black community.
So far this month, representatives have worked together to put on events focused on economic developments, opportunities, and mental health.
This week, legislators are focusing on education and families, a collaboration between Representatives Lakeisha Myers and Sheila Stubbs.
WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell spoke with Myers about how it feels for this Black History Month programming to be one of her first major projects with the caucus since being sworn in just last month.
It feels really good. It feels really good. I'm happy that we are working together as a cohesive unit. I think this is probably the most members the Legislative Black Caucus has ever had. I'm happy that we have members not only from Milwaukee, but from Madison. I think that helps us as far as looking at things from a holistic perspective that everything, you know, there are some issues that happen in Madison that often, frankly, are not heard about. So, you know, when you think about Madison, people always go, oh, Madison, liberal Madison. But, you know, some of the same issues can happen in Madison or in Milwaukee that, you know, happen in other parts of the country. So we have, like I said, a lot of work to do.
So this week, you and Representative Stubbs have chosen to focus on education and families. Why did you guys choose those topics?
Well, I chose that topic because education is kind of my signature field. I was an educator for Milwaukee Public Schools for many years and have been in the classroom and about for over 10 years. So that's where my passion lies. So I worked with Representative Stubbs. She deals a lot with families and issues. So we decided to work together and sponsor that week of activities. So I think we covered a good swath of activities for that week that we have going on.
And so your list of events included a viewing of the film, Tell Them We're Rising, a conversation about Black suffrage in Wisconsin, and a couple of panels on education challenges in Wisconsin, and one on the Oshkosh 94. So talk a little bit about the latter, because I've never heard of the Oshkosh 94.
Absolutely. The second panel that we are having is about Wisconsin's Black history with the Oshkosh 94. And I know that many people in Wisconsin are like, the Oshkosh who? You know, the Oshkosh 94, some of the survivors of that will be coming to the Capitol to speak to students and to members as well to let them know about what happened on Black Thursday back in 1968. This happened in, I believe it was November of 1968. Students that were students at UW-Oshkosh, there were 94 of them, actually took over the chancellor's office. And there were police that were called. It was, you know, an entire situation. These students were hauled off to jails. Some of them were bailed out by Father James Groppi from Milwaukee, as well as others. Lloyd Barbie was also one of their lawyers. And so these are prominent people that we know about in Wisconsin's history, but to have not heard about this instance where these students were lobbying and advocating for Black Studies programs. They were advocating to have Black professors on campuses in the UW system. These students were actually suspended from school. Some of them that were suspended from school were unable to re-enroll in any Wisconsin college. Some of them actually went on to graduate from Oshkosh later on. Some of them, one of them I know for sure, actually ended up going to your alma mater, Marquette. But it was something that was, and some of them actually ended up going and finishing school at HBCUs. Mm-hmm. So there's all of this history that is intertwined in the stories of these 94 students, people that have gone on to become prominent folks in our community. You know, it was like, why did I never hear of this story? You know, I heard about this maybe about 2 years ago, and I was like, what? I never knew any of this happened. You know, when you hear about Black history, it usually focuses on the 200 Nights of Freedom in Milwaukee with the open housing marches and with Father Grappi and Vail Phillips. But to think about history that happened outside of the city of Milwaukee, while many of the 94 students were from Milwaukee, you know, this happened in one of the state colleges. The students were charged with, like, in my opinion, exuberant charges of, like, destruction of property. You know, there was, like, criminal negligence. And, like, I mean, if you look at the list of charges, they could have gone to federal prison for a very long time. And thank God that that did not happen to them. And, you know, they were allowed to, for the most part, finish their education. And, you know, but the things that they were lobbying for are things that we see now in the UW system. There are dedicated services towards students of color. There are African-American cultural centers and Black student unions on a multitude of campuses in the UW system. And I think that students, especially those students of color in the UW system, need to know this story because these were the people that made it possible for you to have an existence, number one, and a viable existence in the UW system. And I know in speaking to, you know, some of the administrators from UW-Madison and well as the in UW system as a whole, we have a long way to go.
I think you bring up a good point that there is still Black history that we don't know because it doesn't get as much attention, if at all, compared to what's more popular, like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech or Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on the bus. Why do you think there is still so much we don't know?
When you look at, and this is me as an educator speaking as well, I think we often like to romanticize the civil rights movement. And we like to give it a rosy, you know, finish, if you will. I think when you think about Black History Month, people go, oh, I had a dream. You know, Martin Luther King, he had a dream. Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat. And we think it stops there. When I was in the classroom and teaching, I used to tell my students that the civil rights movement did not start with a bus and it did not end with a king. So I think that, you know, for having people to have an entire compass of what the civil rights movement looks like, mm-hmm. the different iterations of the civil rights movement, and understanding that there are things that we still have to deal with today.
So what's the importance of having this type of programming in 2019? I mean, all the issues the representatives are choosing to focus on have always been important and will likely continue to be important, but what is it about now that makes them matter even more?
I do think that given the current climate of you see a resurgence of, you know, the far extreme right wing radicalization, the Confederate flag, you know, flying in certain places. For instance, in Toma, Wisconsin, the school board there just outlawed the Confederate flag. Basically, they banned it in that particular school district because they had seen a resurgence in that community where there's a lot of Native Americans mm-hmm. and other people of color. You know, this was used as a tactic to try to silence students of color in that school district. Why else would you fly the rebel battle flag? Like, you know, it's crazy to me. So you're starting to see incidences of things that we thought we were done with, frankly, you know, where you see this like far extreme neo-Nazism, you know, situations in different parts of the Charlottesville, you know, situation. You're starting to see things like this. spur again. And I think it's giving people that were silenced or were kind of demurred for a while, you're starting to see them say, oh, no, I can be bold. So I think this is why we have to highlight these programs and make sure that we are being vocal mm-hmm. about diversity and inclusion, making sure that we have people that have a seat at the table, making sure that, you know, people of color in the state are represented. I think we have to understand that if we want to get better and move forward, we have to embrace all.
And finally, how do we move forward with continuing to educate people about issues affecting the Black community or communities of color as a whole, making sure that the conversations don't stop once February, once Black History Month is over?
I think I can speak for all the members of the Legislative Black Caucus that we are unapologetically Black and that we are looking out for the interests of people of color, especially those of African Americans, every day. We are the people that are thinking, how does this impact our communities on a daily basis when we are, you know, in committee hearings and when we're looking at how different aspects of state law will affect the community. I know those are some of the questions that I'm asking. You know, how does this impact not only my district, but how does it impact African Americans that may live in this community? How does it impact people of color in general? So I know that as a group, we are being, you know, kind of the vanguards for that in asking those questions. So I know, you know, that's something that we are consistently looking at and asking those questions in each of our, you know, our way.
Lakeisha Myers represents the 12th District in the Wisconsin State Assembly. She spoke with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell.
We'll get a preview of this year's rejuvenated Beloit International Film Festival when Lake Feck returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Beloit International Film Festival is a 10-day tribute to the power of film. It's also an appreciation for the indie films made here in the U.S. and around the globe. Each year, the quaint Wisconsin town hosts locals and film tourists alike as audiences get a chance to see films not easily found in the local multiplex.
This year, the festival has an improved short program and an emphasis on female filmmaking. The organization has also seen some leadership and staff structure changes, including a new chairwoman of the board.
That board president is Anna Kelly. She and artistic director Greg Gerard recently joined me in the studio to talk about the Beloit International Film Festival. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Audrey.
Thanks for having us.
So this is the 14th year of the Beloit International Film Festival. And Greg, as its artistic director, what did you want to reimagine or emphasize for this year's festival? Because your position is relatively new, correct?
It is. I've been working for the festival since the beginning. So I've been with them for going on 14 years now. And now I have ascended to a position that they kind of created for me. We kind of restructured how things were operating. So I guess they needed to keep me, so they needed to give me a name. So artistic director was the one that was chosen. And I'm sort of overlapping into a lot of different departments. But one of my main focuses is to program all the feature-length content for the festival, which is, you know, a big chunk of cinema. And I guess I was just looking to match the quality of films that we had last year. You know, we had a great year for submissions last year. And what do you know? We got just a whole, you know, slew of great stuff again this year. And so as I was going, wading through all of this stuff, it started to become apparent that I was seeing more women in film in positions of like writing, directing, producing. Obviously, we've always had great actors, but this seemed unique to me. And so that set me on a course to look a little further into it and maybe set a tone within this year's festival that would be female empowerment, women in film, female empowerment, celebrating that. We've got some nice things planned and it's very exciting.
Well, and do you think that, I mean, of course, there's been the wave of the Me Too movement and the fight to keep that momentum going, not just beyond the news headlines when it was first in prominence, but the fact that it's a smaller festival compared to the distribution that main studios are doing, that you're able to highlight women in film more, that more female filmmakers and producers and editors are thinking of festivals such as the Beloit Film Festival to submit their work, to get that visibility with audiences.
Yeah, I think that we're a very user-friendly and accessible festival. We're a small-town festival. We're very, I guess I've always called it boutique. You know, we did the old Sundance. The founders of the festival based it on a Sundance model where they, have, I guess apparently early on, they would actually convert some of their downtown eating and drinking establishments into theaters. And it's very intimate. It's very warm and friendly. And it's not a lot of 40-foot screens, but it's got something extra special. And I think certainly our film goers have loved it. And we've always heard from our filmmakers that they just enjoy the experience of being, you know, right in there with our film goers in these cool little venues we have.
Now, Anna, as the board president, this position is also relatively new for yourself, right?
Yes.
So where did this need stem from, and what did you want to reimagine or emphasize or highlight for this year's festival?
Well, I've been involved with the festival maybe last 10 years. I've been on the board, I don't know, a few years after that. And when we restructure, I was in line to become president. So I said, okay, I'm president. I've always done a lot for the festival. My husband and I do the website, and we do a lot of other things. But now I think we're much a group together. I'm very frugal. I think it's good to have somebody looking at everything. We want to be very conscious of our sponsors and our filmmakers that we make every penny count to get the best festival that we can for the, you know, for our audiences, for our sponsors, for the filmmakers, and for the city of Beloit. I think, you know, it's a great thing for the town to have this festival. This brings a lot of people in who haven't been to Beloit in a long time or they've never been. And Beloit is changing, and we wanted to see that.
Yeah, many Wisconsinites listening probably don't think of Beloit much besides, like, perhaps a marker on the freeway or something they're passing through. So with you in your new leadership role, what is it about Beloit that you want to show to the world, not just Wisconsin, but, you know, the filmmakers you want to bring in from across the country and the globe?
Beloit's a diverse community, and I think there's something to be said for that. As a small community, you don't see a lot of communities that size that have the diversity that we have. So it's like a small, big city and a small town sort of thing. And the town, we've been there 14 years, and the changes that we've seen happening in the last 14 years, it's like night and day. We wish people could come in and see what's happening. We've got, you know, the downtown, it's beautiful. We got new restaurants. There's a lot of new businesses downtown. I mean, I think it's a sight to see. I think if you come, you'd want to come back. No.
Yeah, and many people probably wouldn't associate small town Wisconsin anywhere, you know, even Beloit or any other town that you could name as a place for a cultural hub where you're getting international films.
We get a lot of people from south of the border, and they just come every year. And we have the Biffy Around, which shows films every Wednesday through the year. And they do Skype Q&As with the filmmakers. And the audiences love it. The filmmakers love it. And I think a lot of those filmmakers are coming to the festival because they really enjoy it, getting the feedback.
Now, part of this year's film festival is, you know, an improvement on curating the short program. So, Greg, when it comes to curating shorts, because it's, I think, probably a little more difficult than features because you need a good, effective short film that can capture the attention of, you know, not only you for choosing something to include in the program, but the audience, you know, the quick effectiveness of something or something that sticks in your brain. So how did you go about programming that? And are there any short films you'd like to highlight in particular?
Well, I have to tell you that I have a young man by the name of Adam Fogarty, who is our shorts programmer. He's also a wonderful curator, and he's the guy that does all of our publicity as well. As you can tell, we're all wearing a lot of different hats because we're a small nonprofit, and that's the way that works. But Adam primarily had the reins over the whole submission, you know, catalog of short films. And then I would, you know, kind of work with him to pick out some certain things that I might need for this, that, or the other thing. And but he's done this for like the last 3 years for us. So he's just done a great job of finding the best of what's come in. Now, I have certain needs of some of these short films. One of them is, of course, our BIF, Kids at BIF program that we do. It's a community outreach thing that we do with fifth graders, and we teach critical thinking exercises with them by way of film. And he came to me as recommending a film called One Small Step as a possible that I could use for the program this year. And what do you know? It got nominated for an Oscar. And we're so excited. This has happened to us a few times. We've actually had a couple of years ago, we had a film called Sing, a short film called Sing, that won the Academy Award. So I'm going to be employing this film liberally in all different parts of the festival. I have to say that Adam has just done a wonderful job for us in the shorts domain.
Well, and it's a great opportunity to happen to get, you know, an Oscar-nominated film. It's not the case when all the submission processes are being done, but for it to get that platform. Do you think that also helps bring enthusiasm for audience members coming in? Because, you know, not many people perhaps have heard of Beloit International Film Festival, but they've heard of the Oscars. Mm-hmm. And they know what it means to have, like, an Academy-nominated picture, actor, director, anything like that. So do you think this is an extended part of your role to be able to provide a place for people to see this? Because otherwise, we're at home watching the Oscars.
Right.
Shorts come up, you're like, I've never heard of that or seen it. Yeah. It's not accessible to people, some of these programs.
It's just like a great addition to our, you know, the little bit of power that we have down there in the corner, in the, you know, on the state line, that we could actually have a film that is gaining that kind of notoriety at something like the Oscars, and we run with it. It's such a great publicity tool, and our,
it's,
you know,
our
area and regional filmgoers hear this, our enthusiasm for a film like this, and I think it just helps to whip up the vibe.
Well, and among the other programs you're mentioning, there's some showcase programs such as Classic Film, BIF Cares, and the Silent Film Showcase. So these aren't necessarily new films that you're bringing that have been submitted. But what is the importance of bringing classic films back to audiences or silent film showcases? Because rarely do we have the experience of seeing a silent film in a theater.
Well, that's just it. These are the ideas of the founders of the festival, Rod Bodwin, Becky Rogers, and Ron Neef, all Beloiters, well, transplanted Beloiters a little bit, but this was their thing, and they put this together. And these classic films, silent film, sing-along film, they've been part of the festival since the beginning. What's the value of something like a classic film? Well, for me, it's to be able to see something like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner on a 40-foot screen. We do these screenings at our, the sing-along and the classic film we do at Schubert's Luxury 10 Theater, which is our little Cineplex in town. And it's amazing to see those. I mean, those were some movie stars, right? People get so used to seeing these movies anymore on just their, you know, even if it's a 80-inch flat screen, still not the same as in the theater, you know, on that big screen. And that, for me, has had the most impact year after year. I go and I watch our classic film every year, and it's a great throwback.
The silent film, it used to be with a symphony, and for the past 3 years, it's with a
Beloit Memorial High School
Jazz Orchestra. They call themselves a jazz orchestra now. So the kids work, you know, really hard. It's a great, great jazz program they have at Beloit Memorial. And it's, I mean, people really like it. I mean, the kids love playing for it, and it's, you wouldn't know it's kids playing the music.
Yeah, it's, they're, of course, they are an award-winning jazz orchestra, and their leader, Chris Behrens, he just draws out every ounce of talent out of these kids. And for the last 3 years, they have been our accompanists for the silent film.
Well, it sounds like it's a big community-driven aspect kind of festival as well. And Anna, having been so involved in the role of the film festival throughout the year and now having more of the executive role, what would you say to someone listening right now to bring them to Beloit and to the Beloit Film Festival. What are some of your favorite aspects that you want other people to experience?
I think Beloit is different than most communities you're in. When you come to Beloit, you feel like you're part of Beloit. Come because Beloit will welcome you. You won't even feel like you're in a strange city. It just, everybody, we have so many volunteers, so many people who just want to welcome you in. I think you're missing out if you don't come. I mean, the festival, it's the biggest example of this. We've got tons of volunteers. People are calling me, where can I volunteer? How do I sign up, you know? And I'm not even the person in charge of that. But it's just a wonderful experience. If it wasn't, I wouldn't have been doing this. I mean, we work November through March, like nonstop for the festival, pretty much. And if this wasn't a wonderful thing, there's no way I could justify spending that kind of time.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, every year we get like in the neighborhood of 400 people that volunteer from town. And our staff is what you call skeletal.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got a lot of people, you know, that just basically they are just donating their time. Well, we've got a good little team and we all put in a lot of time. And so far, so good.
Well, I'm sure the viewers will certainly see all that time and effort come through in a positive light. So, Greg and Anna, I want to thank you both for coming in today to talk about the Beloit International Film Festival.
Thank you
so much, Audrey.
Anna Kelly is the board president for the Beloit International Film Festival, and Greg Girard is its artistic director. The festival starts tomorrow and runs through March 3rd. We'll feature more interviews with filmmakers presented in the festival in shows to come, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Another break, and then we'll catch up with Wauwatosa native Grace Weber, whose new album will come out this year, the first since she signed a deal with Capitol Records. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Sometimes you just have a suspicion a person is going to go on to big things. Almost exactly 11 years ago, we interviewed an up-and-coming singer-songwriter who had just released her first CD. At the time, Wauwatosa native Grace Weber was 19 years old, a student at NYU, and half of the artistic duo of Grace and Julian. And this is a taste of what that first album, also called Grace and Julian, sounded like.
I get down when I read your goodbyes, and I feel lost when there's nowhere to hide.
In the time since, Weber graduated from NYU and kept making music.
In the late, I see my face, loneliest.
In recent years, she's worked with some accomplished musicians along the way, including Chance the Rapper, with whom she toured South America, and she founded a nonprofit here in Milwaukee to enhance music education opportunities for kids. And then last year came maybe the brightest news yet, a recording contract with Capitol Records, which will put out her new album this year. Grace Weber was back home over the holidays and visited us then. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So I was thinking about the first time that you were on this show, and I think you were like a freshman or a sophomore in college. So then we look at where you are now. Do you wake up one morning and it hits you that you have gotten to the point that you have been working to all these years?
You know, I do allow myself that some days. I'm like, you know, I have to let myself celebrate that I've achieved this thing that I had always dreamed of, and like, wow, I really arrived at this point where I signed a record deal with this legendary, iconic label. Like, I have to let myself celebrate that, because I think what I do sometimes is, okay, I've reached this point, now what's the next thing? And I don't let myself really enjoy the moment of patting myself on the back and being like, okay, cool, I did that. You know, let's pop open a bottle of champagne and toast to it. So I've been trying to let myself enjoy it.
Well, and you know, you think about it, and it's not necessarily like, you know, keeping it real and celebrating aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, you know, you can think about like these milestones along the way that you want to work towards without necessarily forgetting that there are still like other mileposts down the road, right?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to say it. And it's all about, you know, maintaining the balance of, okay, I'm really driven to keep going, doing what I want to do, and also realizing that there's never really a point that you ultimately arrive at in art. It's always just, and just in life, it's always, okay, now let's see what's around the next corner and let's just keep going.
The other thing that hits me as I was kind of trying to look back at everything you have done since we talked in whatever that was, 2007 mm-hmm. and 2008, is just how many opportunities that you took advantage of between then and now. Do you develop a philosophy when it comes to taking on collaborations and choosing the opportunities?
You know, for the most part, I've been really blessed with having cool opportunities. It's sort of like a breadcrumb is the way that I look at it. Like, you know, the universe sort of puts these little breadcrumbs in front of me like, okay, do this, keep going. This is going to lead you to the next thing. And as long as I have an attitude of curiosity and openness and wonder, usually whatever it is, whatever the opportunity is, whether it's something, you know, I've done things too that haven't really led me anywhere or have been things that, you know, weren't the best experiences, but because I went into it with a vision of, okay, I'm just going to see what this teaches me, I always learn something from it, and then it, you know, has led me down the path that I'm on. When I was in high school, if you had told me, okay, you're not really going to start hitting your stride as far as knowing yourself as an artist, being kind of in your flow professionally until you're 30, I would have said, oh, no, no way. I'm going to give up before then. But that's what my path, you know, has been a journey of at each turn, I learned something that I would have never expected and helped me grow in a really big way and helped me become the artist that I am today. So
were there moments you thought of giving up?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's, you know, being, I think it was moments of wondering if the stress was worth it. You know, it's always these moments of like, oh, I'm so stressed about making it. But at every moment when I had those little blips of, okay, should I keep going? I would always ask myself, well, do I love singing? And the answer was yes. And then it was, okay, well, I can do this without the stress. I'm putting the stress on myself, deciding that I have to reach a certain level or hit this certain goal. I can just focus on the art and the music, you know, as long as I'm focused on why I love singing and getting on stage and sharing my voice with people, then again, it doesn't matter where I'm at. It's like I'm always doing what I love, and then I'm happy.
When you talk about all these collaborations that you've done and people you've sung with and people have sung with you and opportunities you've had to do, you know, performances in kind of unusual places sometimes, is there a secret to doing all of these things and still coming out at the end of the day or end of the show or end of the album sounding like Grace Weber?
Yes. I think the secret is knowing yourself and really and learning when to say no to things. I always want to live under the sort of the year of yes, like Shonda Rhimes says, but when you really know yourself, you know what's gonna work for you as an artist. And I think that's when you really start hitting your stride. It's like, you know, this is my lane. This is what makes me happy. And also when you're collaborating with people, if you know yourself, your voice is always going to shine through no matter what the collaboration is. And so I think for me, it took me a little bit to feel that strength in being able to say, you know, this is who I am. This is the type of music that I love doing. These are my values. And these are the people that I want to align myself with. And really, for me, it came down to I want to make music with my friends, and I want to make music with people who bring me joy. And so when that is sort of your value, then it becomes easier to say no to things that don't bring you joy. Or like, you know, I don't really want to align myself with somebody who is bringing me down or isn't aligned with the value of love and light and all those things. So yeah, I think it's as long as you are very sturdy in who you are, no matter what you're doing, you're going to shine through.
I wonder if one of the lessons in growing up in this business is realizing that you can say no and people will continue to ask you.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good way of saying it.
Talk a little bit about the record deal. I mean, I think many of us have this, we have this image in our mind of the record deal happening when some record company person is in the audience at a concert and then pulls the artist aside after they come off stage and says,
hey,
we
kid, with a big cigar in their mouth.
Exactly, and a contract that they're holding on to and a big check. I imagine that is not how the Capitol Records deal happened.
No. I mean, it was sort of magical a little bit in the sense it felt very right. Like it felt very much like the stars were aligning. Basically, we released, Binta and I, Binta's my manager, we released my first song off of the album called, the song was called More Than Friends in November of last year. And we released it independently. And 2 weeks before we put it out, we decided we were putting it out. Like, we didn't have this huge, big plan. We just were cut. Binta was like, you know what? Let's put out More Than Friends. Like, that song's ready. Even though the rest of the album isn't finished, let's just put it out and see what happens. And it was both of us just kind of jumping in and trusting each other and trusting the universe and trusting that, okay, this is the right time. Let's do it.
Funny how it all came down. Funny how it all came down to this. Wondering where you are, leaving with a bad taste on your lips. What would you say to me if I was happily alone?
So we put out More Than Friends, and it hit this playlist called New Music Friday, which is a really big playlist, especially at the time on Spotify, and you know, it got millions of plays, and John Mayer randomly heard it and posted a screenshot of the song on his Instagram. Just like all these really cool things happened that were unexpected and fun. And Capitol, an A&R at Capitol named Aaron, ended up hearing More Than Friends on a playlist that wasn't even like a fancy discovery playlist. It was just sort of a random playlist that she was listening down to, heard More Than Friends, and emailed Binta the next day and said, you know, I really love this song, can we get on the phone? And actually a lot of labels reached out, but Aaron and Capitol, they were the only ones that were seemed really focused on the music. You know, when Binta talked to Aaron, it was Aaron wasn't asking questions of like, oh well, you know, who else is on the album? Is she, I heard she's collaborating with Chance, or it was none of that. It was just, you know, we love Grace. We love her voice. We love her music. Her music moves me. Like I feel things when I listen to her music. And that's the type of, you know, those are the type of people that I want to work with on the business side, are people who are excited about the art and are excited about the way it makes them feel versus tracking the numbers of, okay, well, how many, you know, Instagram followers does she have? Or, and so there was the way that the conversation was going was really resonating with us. And then the head of A&R at Capitol did come out to a show. It was interesting. I felt more relaxed that he was in the room.
You knew he was there.
Yeah, and I felt like a sense of kind of like when you have like a mentor or a, I don't even know why I felt like this, but I felt when he walked into the room, I felt more calm. From then, you know, it was just a process of figuring out the deal. And then when I went in to sign, I got to, you know, walk into the Capitol Records building with the big tower and
In Hollywood,
and, you know, signed the paperwork, and then they had a bottle of champagne, and we went to the roof, and they gave me a tote bag and a T-shirt.
It must have been just a little bit surreal.
It was. It was surreal. There were cupcakes. And it also felt really normal. I think that's the other thing that I like about Capitol is, like, all the people that work there are really cool. You know, it feels like friends. You know, it's just, there's a real sense of community and support. Like, I got to meet a group of other women who were signed that year as well. A few weeks later, I did this thing with five other women who were recently signed, and I got to meet them, and they were all so cool, and it just felt like this real sense of camaraderie and, you know, no competition, just kind of like, oh, cool, like, we're all experiencing this together and getting to talk about, you know, okay, well, what's it like for you? What's it like for you? And but the people on my team at Capital are also just so cool. That's what, I was also just surprised how, like, everyone's just super down to earth. It's been a really good journey so far, and I'm just trying to keep reminding myself, like, just take it a day at a time, keep having fun, don't, you know, I have to journal a lot about not getting in my head. I tend to overthink things, and I do compare myself a lot to other musicians and artists who I'm friends with or who I look up to, and, oh, you know, am I not, you know, doing enough because I'm not getting enough likes on this post? You know, I struggle with all that stuff, and I have to remind myself to keep, like I said before, recalibrating my compass and remember what's important. And then, and again, like you said, honestly, celebrating the Capital thing helps me recalibrate it too in a way of like, you know what, let me just enjoy this for a second. And my album is done, so I've been enjoying that and really like enjoying the moment, which sounds cliche, but hey, it's the truth. What do you see?
Did Mercy come out before you signed the deal or after?
After, yeah.
So do you feel when you put out a single after you sign a record deal that is there more pressure in the success or failure of a particular song when you've got the backing of a label behind you?
I put more pressure on myself, which was interesting. Like, it was really eye-opening experience because Capital, they seemed almost happier than I was. I was like, oh, well, shouldn't it be doing more? Should we get more plays? And they were like, congratulations, this is great. You know, we're so happy. So, but they didn't put the pressure on me. I actually kind of put the pressure on myself. So I've really been trying to process that. Like, okay, cool, this is interesting. Like, there isn't as much pressure as I thought there would be. There is definitely things that are different. Like, you know, I'm trying to find the balance between, I've been doing this by myself for so long. Well, with Binta. But as far as the two of us really crafting every single release and, you know, every cover that we do is just like, I ask my friend who's an artist to help me out, or my buddy who's a graphic designer to do this, or, my brother helped me make the website. And now it's like, you know, the website needs to get cleared by like a whole legal team to make sure that, you know, there's a lot more people. There's like 40 people, you know, versus two.
The Grace Weber entourage.
Yeah, it's like a whole new, and you have to really learn the balance of realizing that all these new people on your team want to be involved just as much as, you know, they want to feel excited about the process, and you have to let them into the process and not be afraid of having to control everything and being so precious about everything, but still maintaining your artistry. So it's just this balance of, okay, you know, I can like let you in, plus I can still be like guiding the ship. So far it's been a really beautiful experience, and I also get access to work with all these new artists. And you know, the person who I'm going to be working with to shoot my album cover, this is probably way too TMI, but oh well, not TMI, it's just we're not releasing all the info yet. So I'll just say photographer who's shooting my album cover is this really amazing artist that I probably would have never gotten to work with if not for signing. So I get access to all these really cool things and kind of like keeping it all in the family while also extending the family. We're marrying into a large extended family.
I mean, it sounds almost like the difference between being a guy who has built his own house and then becomes an architect and, you know, has other people build the house for him, but it is still his house.
Yeah, it's like everybody is kind of painting the picture together. What other metaphors can we do?
Yeah, I know.
We're baking a cake. Everyone's throwing in their own spice.
Right, you become the executive chef instead of the
like,
sous chef.
Yes.
So the album is done.
Yes.
Does Capital become any part of the creative process, or it's done and they sign off on it?
Well, the beautiful thing about this was the album was done when we signed the deal. I mean, we had a couple little pieces that we still had to fill in. But the idea was that Binta and I were going to finish. Binta's the executive producer of the album as well, so that we were going to finish all those little details ourselves. And Capitol's been really supportive in helping us finish, but we really, you know, all the creative of this album was ours and was mine and done. And so it was a cool experience of Capitol hearing the album and, you know, signing off before I even signed. So then it was a feeling of like, okay, cool. They really like me for who I am. They love the album. They don't want to change anything. They don't want to change me. They love, you know, my style, my fashion, the art, the covers, like everything about me. They were like, you're great, you're cool. And it's a very refreshing feeling of like, you sure I don't have to do a tap dance or a, it's just kind of like, no, we think you're dope. And so, yeah, the album was done and we just mastered it. So now we're just going on the journey of releasing it and I'm pretty excited.
And presumably there will be a tour and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Hopefully we're going to do, we're starting to book out my headlining tour now. And the idea is like kind of once the album drops, just kind of go, you know, for hopefully the next 2 years after the album drops is going to be pretty intense. So I'm kind of prepping myself for that and trying to get into a good mindset. And then also then we'll start working on the album number two, hopefully too. So keep creating, keep reminding myself that it's all about the love of the music and really like, especially when you're trying, there's no roadmap, you know, like there's no degree that you can get that's going to help you get a job in the industry. It's all about being in the right place at the right time for the thing that's right for you.
Grace Weber, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What do you see? While Wauwatosa native and Pius High School alum Grace Weber signed a deal with Capitol Records last fall. The new album will be out this year, but there are already several tracks out, and you can find a link to them from WUWM.com. Our interview with Grace first aired in January.
One last break, and then we'll listen back to a reading from a powerful 2014 novel that is still attracting audiences around the world. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Emily St. John Mandel had written three books before her novel, Station 11. But suffice it to say, a majority of the millions of people who are now her fans found her work thanks to her 2014 work. The book takes place 20 years after a pandemic has decimated the population and tells the story of a woman who goes along with a small traveling group of actors and musicians, entertaining the few who are left.
Mandel's book has reached many more people in recent days thanks to its inclusion as a big read book through the National Endowment for the Arts. That allows programs around the country to receive grants to help fund community-wide common reads. That's the case in Wauwatosa, where the TOSA All-City Read this year is Station 11.
There has been programming for weeks surrounding that book, and it will culminate with an event with Emily St. John Mandel in conversation with Mitch this Sunday. Here's a reading from Station 11, which she shared on Lake Effect not long after that book came out.
What was lost in the collapse? Almost everything, almost everyone, but there is still such beauty. Twilight in the Altered World, a performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream in a parking lot in the mysteriously named town of St. Deborah by the water, Lake Michigan shining a half mile away. Kirsten is Titania, a crown of flowers on her close-cropped hair, the jagged scar on her cheekbone half erased by candlelight. The audience is silent. Saeed, circling her in a tuxedo that Kirsten found in a dead man's closet near the town of East Jordan. Tarry, rash wanton, am I not thy lord? Then I must be thy lady. Lines of a play written in 1594, the year London's theaters reopened after two seasons of plague. Or written possibly a year later, in 1595, a year before the death of Shakespeare's only son. Some centuries later, on a distant continent, Kirsten moves across the stage in a cloud of painted fabric, half in rage, half in love. She wears a wedding dress that she scavenged from a house near New Potowski, the chiffon and silk streaked with shades of blue from a child's watercolor kit. But with thy brawls, she continues, thou hast disturbed our sport. She never feels more alive than at these moments. When on stage, she fears nothing. Therefore the winds, piping to us in vain, as in revenge, have sucked up from the sea contagious fogs. Pestilential, a note in the text explains, next to the word contagious, in Kirsten's favorite of the three versions of the text that the symphony carries. Shakespeare was the third born to his parents, but the first to survive infancy. Three of his siblings died young. His son, Hamnet, died at 11 and left behind a twin. Plague closed the theaters again and again, death flickering over the landscape. And now in a twilight once more lit by candles, the age of electricity having come and gone, Titania turns to face her fairy king. Therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air, that rheumatic diseases do abound. Oberon watches her with his entourage of fairies. Titania speaks as if to herself now, Oberon forgotten. Her voice carries high and clear over the silent audience, over the string section waiting for their cue on stage left. And through this distemperature, we see the seasons alter. All three caravans of the Traveling Symphony are labeled as such, the Traveling Symphony, lettered in white on both sides. But the lead caravan carries an additional line of text, because survival is insufficient.
Emily St. John Mandel reading from her 2014 novel Station 11, back in 2014. I'll be talking with Mandel about the book Sunday afternoon at the Celtic MKE Center on Wauwatosa Avenue, part of events surrounding the TOSA All-City Read. You can find a link to more information and hear our full 2014 interview at WUWM.com. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and each weekday at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.